So we're heading toward the end of Matthew chapter 6 tonight. We'll begin in verse 19. We're going to look down through verse 24 tonight, and we'll see about that last section. You know, we did the don't worry about living in our spiritual health regimen, which is what that last section of chapter 6 is about. So we don't want to be redundant with that and do it again. But then again, I know Paul on numerous occasions repeated the same things again to remind us of those things. So sometimes it might be good to hear some thoughts on those things again and be reminded. But we'll see what occurs between now and then. And I'll see if I can find something new to say about what Jesus said 2,000 years ago. No, probably not, can I? Because it's all been said. There's been 2,000 years of people talking about what He said. Entire books have been written on the things that He said in these three chapters. It is something. Tells you how fully packed the words that our Savior spoke were. He did not waste a single word. Every word that He spoke had, well, all words have meaning, but they were specifically chosen for their meaning. And He gave them in just the right way, in just the right order, and just to get across the very message that He wanted to get across. The only problem that many of us have today is that we don't speak Greek, so we have to have it translated. And sometimes it's hard to get exactly that same meaning translated into another language. We get as close as we can. There are words that mean pretty much the same thing, but then it just still, not like if we had been there and understood His language as He spoke it, but we can still get the understanding of it and learn the lessons He wanted us to learn from these things, and we certainly need to do that. This is a touchy subject. You ever shy away from touchy subjects? This isn't one that I would have chosen to talk about, because it hits a little too close to home for many of us, especially those of us here in America. Now, the Bible has a lot to say about money. I know money's a physical thing and the Bible's a book about spiritual things, but well, there's an awful lot in there about money and about possessions, about physical things. Well, I imagine that makes sense. Since we live in a physical world, God wants to tell us how to live in this world without falling to the pitfalls that are all around us. And one of the biggest dangers there is comes in the danger of materialism. Becoming materialistic is quite a danger for all of us, because it can be so tempting to put our faith and trust in the things that we can see and that we can touch. Helps us be more comfortable. We talked about it a little bit this morning when we talked about walking as Jesus walked, and we talked about the fact that He was homeless, but He doesn't expect us to be homeless. But at the same time, there are some people who have houses that they need to sell because that house has become a god to them in place of God. Well, let's look at this and see what Jesus has to say. Verse 19. He says, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust does corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal." Now that statement in and of itself is pretty straightforward. Don't lay up treasures on earth. And he even gives good reason. Well, you might lose it. It might be stolen. It might, you know, just waste away. If you ever had a vehicle and you just left it sitting up for a while, you'll find it won't run if you leave it sitting there too long. So you can't just save some things up. They wear out. The rust gets them. The moths get them. They have mothballs to keep the moths out of the closets and those kinds of things. How do you know whether you're laying up treasures on earth? How do you know if you're guilty of doing what Jesus has said don't do right here? That's a tricky question. It's a tough one. Is there a dollar amount that crosses the line? You know, if I've got $99,949 in my account, I'm okay. But if I've got $99,951, then I'm storing up treasures. Is that the way that works? Does it have to do with your net worth? You know, I've got this house, and I've got the car, and I've got this retirement fund, and that, and land, and this, and that, and the other, and all together it's worth X amount, and so that, well, I'm over the limit. I got to sell $15 worth of stuff so and give that to charity, so I'm back under that limit, and I'm not storing up my treasures on earth. Is that worth it? Does it work like that? Could it be that someone who doesn't even have $100 in a bank account could be laying up treasures on earth while someone who has $1 billion isn't? Is that possible? Now, I want us to think about this. Notice, sometimes what's not said is just as important as what is said. Jesus does not give an amount, does he? He doesn't say, well, X number of, well, they wouldn't have used dollars back then anyway, but he didn't say X number of, you know, this particular version of money of some kind, or a house that's worth a certain amount, or land that's worth a certain amount is too much, and you're storing up treasures on earth. He doesn't give an amount. It's not a number. See, like all the other things that Jesus has dealt with in the Sermon on the Mount, I mean, we would be happy if it had a number. If we say, okay, well, $1 million, okay, I'm under that, I'm okay. Or, oops, I'm over that, I better get back under. We'd be happy if there was just a dollar amount there, and I know I'm over that, or I know I'm under that. But like the other things that he talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, it's about the heart. It's about the attitude. It's not a number that determines whether someone is hoarding or storing up treasure. That's not what it's about. See, the problem that we have is the old saying, money makes the world go round. Well, we know not literally, but it certainly makes economies go around, doesn't it? When there's a shortage of money and a shortage of business transactions taking place, the economy gets sluggish and, you know, it's not good. Our society, like a lot of other societies, is revolving around money and stuff. Now, Jesus wasn't opposed to money. When they asked him about paying taxes, he said, bring me a coin. And that's something, he didn't even have a coin in his pocket to pull one out. He said, bring me one. Let me see it. But they show it to him and he said, whose image is on here? Oh, that's Caesar's. Well, give to Caesar what Caesar's then. But Jesus bought things, encouraged the disciples to buy things on occasion. He told the disciples on one occasion to go buy food for all the hungry people. And they said, well, Lord, we don't have that much money in the money bag. We can't do that. And so he performed a miracle to feed those folks. But you know, we think about it. How much of a role does stuff play in your life? What is the thing in your life that's most precious to you? And what if you lost that thing? What would you do? How would you feel? And one of the indications that our society as a whole is too materialistic and too obsessed with stuff is the storage rental business. You know the storage rental business. We've got a couple of them right here in Faraday. There's one over here by Budget Build and one out by Bill and Margaret's house. And I don't know, maybe I know there's some over in Vidalia too. I mean, they're everywhere. There are 50,000 plus of these businesses in the United States that rent out an empty room. for anywhere from 15 to 75 or 100. Some of those climate-controlled ones, like over there on the way to Vidalia, there. Ooh, now some of those can be pretty expensive, I think. Well, $100 a month. Now, they have their purposes, don't they? Somebody's moving, you know, but they don't know where they're moving. You know, they got to put their stuff somewhere there until they get the house to put it in, and we understand that. But do you ever think about how many of those places are rented to someone who has had stuff sitting in there for years? They're paying month after month after month to keep stuff in a room where they never see it, they never use it, they won't sell it, they won't give it to charity, they won't give it to their friends or neighbors or family. And it's locked up in that little room to try to keep the thieves from stealing it. I tried to find some numbers on how much money that those businesses make in a year. I heard Clark Howard from Atlanta, CNN, say, I heard a little report about that just this past week. It's weird how, you know, when you're on a certain topic, you hear something about that other places. But he talked about that very thing, but I didn't catch the numbers. But it's millions of dollars every year that these businesses make, renting storage space so people can put their stuff. And when we think about the fact, now, 1 in 10 families in the United States uses these. Now, like I said, some of them, you know, it's a temporary thing. You got to put stuff there, and then you'll come back and get it out, put it in your house or whatever. But some people use it permanently, year after year, for storage. Why do they do that? Because they got so much stuff that there's not room in their house for it. Chances are, they've also got a garage or a storage building, and it's full too, and they ran out of room in there to store stuff, and so they're having to put it somewhere else. And even people that aren't using the storage places that you have to pay for probably have a storage building of some kind where they're storing stuff. Most of us probably do. I know, of course, some things are things you use. You know, you have a place to put your lawnmower or tools or something that you might use, gardening things or whatever, and that's understandable. You're going to use that. But, you know, a lot of stuff, we just store it up. And we store it, and we store it, and are we ever going to use it? Are we ever going to get rid of it? Why are we keeping it? There's some questions to ask ourselves and think about when we think about these things. You know, we've heard of that show they have on TV about the hoarders. I don't know if you've watched one of those. I've experienced that firsthand, so I have no interest in watching one of those shows. I have a relative who literally was a hoarder. And y'all know, it wasn't a while back. Last year, I had to go and help clean that house out. And we hauled off a dumpster as long as this pew and 4 feet high, and as wide as, you know, 3 pews, and it was full of garbage. Newspapers from 1973 were piled up in that house. Amazing stuff. But can't throw anything away, can't get rid of anything, can't you just gotta keep it. And we're all tempted to keep some things. How many of you have some clothes? Haven't worn them in years. Just keep thinking, well, maybe I'm going to wear that again, so I better hang on to it a little longer. You know, that style may come back around again, or I may get back into that size, and we do that. The key to overcoming some of these struggles is understanding one thing. As a Christian, nothing belongs to me. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to God, and He's put me in charge of managing it for him. Now, as his manager, he gives me certain benefits and certain responsibilities. I get to eat food with his money. I get to buy clothes with his money. And I bet y'all are all glad I have clothes. I know I am. I get to have transportation with his money. I get to pay for heating and air conditioning with his money. But I'm going to have to answer to him for how I spent that money, and that's the key. It's not my money just to spend it any way I want to. We hear that all the time, and we think it. We think, well, it's my money, I'll do what... No, it's not. If you're a Christian, it's not your money. It's God's. And He's given it to you to manage it. And as the manager, God expects me and expects you to make the best use of it. Sometimes in church we call that stewardship. Stewardship's just the old English way of saying manager. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. You're storing up treasures. It's not yours. You remember the rich fool? He said, oh, I'm going to tear down my barns and build bigger barns. Sound like he needed to store up more stuff, didn't he? Didn't have enough stuff. Needed to store some more. God said, you fool, this very night your soul shall be demanded of you. And then whose are all these things going to be? What are you going to, you're going to be gone and all this stuff's going to go to somebody else. I know, you can write out a will and you can leave it to somebody. Solomon talked about that in Ecclesiastes. He said, and who's to know whether the person who comes after you will be wise or a fool? How many people have worked hard, become millionaires, left that money to their children who squandered it? I don't have a number on that, but I can think of a few that are in the process of trying to do that right now. It happens. So, God wants me to do the best with this stuff. So, see if this sounds like the best thing. If you gave me some of your money to manage, and I know we already said it's not your money, but if you gave me some money to manage it, and you want me, you do the best with it. Get me the best value with this money. Now suppose I went out and bought a TV set and a couch with half that money. And then I went and rented a storage space and put that couch and that TV in the storage space and paid them rent every month to keep it in there for you. Would you be happy with me after about 6 months or a year like that? Would you think I was really doing a good job with that money you gave me? I have to wonder what God thinks about what we're doing with some of the money that He's given us to manage. And not just the money. Is that the best use of the things? What's the couch made for? Well, it's for people to sit on. Is it serving its purpose if it's sitting up in that storage somewhere? Huh? We'd be better off to at least give it to somebody who doesn't have a couch so they could have one than to just stick it off in storage. I know. We touch on some touchy subjects here. Do we really believe that piling things up and paying not to use them and then not let anyone else make use of them either is the best way to manage God's money? You want to stand in judgment and say, well, this is what I did with what you gave me, God. There's this parable about that, isn't there? Remember the parable of the talents and the one who took his and buried it in the ground? He didn't use it. He didn't let anybody else use it. It was useless. So Jesus does give us an alternative. In verse 20, He says, store your treasure in heaven. Because up there, nothing can happen to damage it. Thieves can't get it. There's no rust, there's no moths, there's nothing bad that can happen to it. You know, people spend a great deal of money on security systems and locks and even guards in some places. Some of these gated communities where they've got a gate and a guard and everything and security people and all these things to keep people from stealing these things. Money on climate control and pest control to keep the stuff from ruining. But you know, none of that's necessary if we'll store our treasure in heaven. Even the IRS can't get it up there. And that's saying something, because the IRS can get just about anything anywhere. I mean, that nobody could get Al Capone, but the IRS got him, you know. I mean, they'd get anybody. You know, other people, if they want your money, they got to sue you or something, or else they've got to steal it, and they could be in danger of getting caught and thrown in prison. But the IRS, they just show up and they say, "I want to give it," and you got to give it. And if you don't give it, they'll throw you in jail. It seems a little backwards, you know. The robber comes and says, "Give me all your money," and you won't give it to him. "Oh, I'm going to have you thrown in jail." Then you wouldn't give me your money. But that's the way that works. But they can't get to heaven. They can't take it. There's a story about man who's being audited by the IRS, and they were discussing. He said, "Oh, I'm rich." I said, "Ha ha ha! He's rich. Yeah, I've got a mansion on a gold street. I've got a crown. I've got a sword that's over 2,000 years old. It's an antique." IRS agent said, "Well, you never claimed any of this. How do you do that on this little salary that you've been reporting to the IRS?" He said, "Oh, I've got all this from my father. From your father." "Well, there's no record of you paying inheritance tax on that when you inherited all that stuff either. So there's a problem here. You're going to owe a great deal of money." The fellow said, "Well, my father, he gives me all sorts of other blessings too, all sorts of gifts. He gives me sunshine and rain, and he gives me food and makes sure I have clothing. And he said, my father's God. Got an unlimited talk plan with him." The IRS agent was frustrated and wound up muttering on his way out, "Well, we don't have jurisdiction in heaven." You know, he couldn't get that mansion. He could get the one here, but he can't get the one up there. So in verse 21, Jesus gets back to the heart of the matter. And like so many things in life, there are really only two choices. Now I know we want to have hundreds of choices. Burger King just brought out a new thing with all sorts of different Coke flavors. I haven't seen all of them yet, but they claim there's hundreds of different flavors that you can choose from. And I know Sonic had up there one time on their thing that they had like 500 and something thousand different possible combinations you could get. Oh, we love choices. But the fact of the matter is, most choices aren't that complicated. There's either A or B. And that's the way Jesus said it is here. You either lay up your treasures on earth or heaven. These are your two choices. And then he explains why we need to choose heaven. Verse 21, he says, your heart's going to be where your treasure is. Your feelings, your thoughts, your time, and your money is going to be spent on what's most valuable to you. So again, let's think about what's most important to you. If you aren't sure, then ask yourself, what do I think about? What do I have the strongest feelings about? What do I spend most of my time on? And what do I spend my money on? And that starts to tell us what's important to us. Some folks spend more on cable in a month than they give the church in a year. That's not even a treasure you can hang on to. But that's the way it is. You know, if we're obsessed with physical stuff, then we'll sacrifice our relationships. We'll spend our money to get that stuff, that particular item, that we've just got to have it. And we'll even lose our soul trying to keep them, trying to keep those things. You know, being willing to sacrifice the physical for the relational and spiritual is a sign of maturity. It's a sign of not physical maturity, but spiritual maturity. When I reach the point that I recognize that things are just things, when I get to the point where I begin to love people and use things instead of loving things and using people, have I gotten to that point in my life yet? If not, I might want to work on that growing up process, because loving things too much is a very destructive thing. We've been talking about what's the one thing that you have that's the most important thing to you. Maybe it's an antique. Maybe it's something that really doesn't have a lot of monetary value, but it has some sentimental value. Maybe it's something you got from your mother or grandmother, some relative, a father or grandfather or uncle or aunt, or maybe it's something like that. Whatever that thing is, would you be willing to tell God, "Lord, if this thing is too important to me, if it's more important to me than it should be, if it is beginning to take your place in my life and in my heart, get rid of it"? Now see, here's the thing. If we can honestly pray that prayer to God, then it's probably not there yet. But if we don't want to say that because we're too afraid that if we said that He'd take it away, chances are He ought to take it away because it is taking His place. So think about those things that are precious to you. And ask yourself, could I really tell God that I would choose Him over this thing and that He could just take it away and I'd be okay with that? It's a challenge. Several years ago, before Xander was born, we had a car. It wasn't a new car. We've never owned a new car. But it was close. It was only 1 year old when we got it. And we liked that car a lot. And it was a good car. Now, it wasn't a real expensive car. It was a Chevy Lumina. But they were pretty good cars. I guess some of them still are. The one we had isn't. But we had that car, and in fact, in Bible class, we were discussing this very subject. And we talked about the very fact that sometimes if God sees that something is becoming too important for us, that we're loving it too much, that He may take that thing away from us. It wasn't a week later that we totaled that car. So I'm telling you, when I preach this lesson, I'm wondering what's going to disappear. I hope that it's not something that involves my life, that I don't wind up dead because it's my life that I love too much. Jesus said, if you want to come after me, you've got to even hate your own life. You can't even love your own physical life more than me. We've got to be careful. There are any number of things that could become too special to us. Verse 22. We need to ask ourselves the question, how are your eyes? Now, I'm not talking about do you have 20/20 vision. I doubt most of us, as we get older, we don't keep that 20/20 vision like we had. Some of us started pretty young not having 20/20 vision. But that's not what we're talking about. Not our physical eyes. What about your spiritual eyes? How do you look at things spiritually? Do you look at them with a pure eye, with a good eye, or an evil eye? Because that's what he asks us about in verses 22 and 23. Are you focused on the single source of light? I'm not talking about the sun, I'm talking about God. If you're looking for ways to please God more, if you're sincerely looking at the Scriptures, if you're keeping your eyes on Christ, our example, then your whole life will show it. And the things of this earth will be dim in your eyesight because of the brightness of His light. You know, when Saul met Jesus on the road to Damascus, and that bright light, you know, he couldn't see anything. He couldn't see anything around him for a while. If we'll keep our eyes on Jesus, we won't even see a lot of the things that are surrounding us. But he says in verse 23, there's another side to that. Again, there are two choices. If you're looking at everything that should be pure and holy to see how you can take advantage of the situation for your own selfish desires, well, then what should have been good in your life has become evil. This was the problem the Pharisees had. They had become so hypocritical because they were looking at every situation that ought to be pure and good as a way to get it over on somebody, to take advantage of somebody. See, when even the good things are corrupted, then how wicked is the rest of that person's life? And that's what Jesus says. How great is that darkness? If your eye's evil, if you're looking at things in an evil way, Titus 1 and verse 15 captures this thought. Unto the pure all things are pure, but unto them that are defiled and unbelieving is nothing pure. Even their mind and conscience is defiled. James 1, 6 through 8 talks about the double-minded man asking God for things. But he says sometimes that you don't get what you ask for because you ask for the wrong reasons. You ask selfishly, wanting to use it on your own sinful desires, your own fleshly lusts. And then he says, you've also got to ask with a singleness of heart, with faith, not doubting God, because if you doubt, you're a double-minded man, and you're unstable in all your ways, and you can't expect to get anything from God like that. See, God doesn't play this one foot in, one foot out kind of game. He won't play. He'll just take his ball and go home if you want to try to play that way. Then verse 24, Jesus closes this section out by giving us the ultimatum, the choice. Again, just two. You don't have to choose from 573,464. Just two. Two choices. He says it is impossible to serve God, and the King James says mammon. Mammon was actually a false god that was devoted to avarice and greed and wealth. That people they worshipped wealth. Well, we got some people today that worship wealth. They'll do anything for a dollar. Anything. Ultimately, see, you're going to choose one or the other. You can't serve them both. It's not possible. There is only room in the human heart and mind for one God. Now see, the thing about the all these false gods that people call gods, and that people, they can share their car and the house, and because the car and the house don't care. Because they're not real. Well, I mean, they're physical things, but they're not alive. They're not real. They're not gods. Not really. But you see, God cares. And He says, you have no other God beside me. There's not room for a second throne in your heart. One throne, that's it. And you got to decide, do you want yourself on that throne? And then you can do all sorts of things with all these other fake gods out there. Whatever you want. Or do you want God on the throne? And then you can't do whatever you want with all these other false gods out there. That's the choice. And that's a choice that every one of us has to make. See, because ultimately God and greed and avarice and wealth, the worship of wealth, not money itself, we know that it's not the money that's evil, it's the love of the money that's evil. But God and greed are totally incompatible. Can you imagine what this world would have been like if our God was a greedy God instead of a giving, sacrificing, selfless kind of God? I shudder to imagine what life would be like on this earth if God was greedy. But He's not. And we're so blessed because He's not. But He calls on us to be like Him and to shun greed and avarice and the worship of wealth. 1 Timothy 6:10, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. You see, you can't have the love of money and the love of God both sharing a place in your heart, because one is a righteous thing and one's an evil thing. They don't belong together. They're like oil and water. They don't mix. Even more than oil and water, they're like two magnets that push each other apart. They won't even touch each other. So we've got to choose. Just as Joshua called on the people of his day to choose the living God or the gods of the Amorites or the gods from their past history, you pick. You don't have to pick one or the other. You can't serve them both. Jesus has been calling on everyone from His day to ours. And He'll continue calling till the end of time. Right here in Matthew 6, He calls on us. Make the choice. Who are you going to serve? Which are you going to pick? The spiritual or the physical? The eternal or the temporal? Joy or pleasure? And there's a difference in those two. Drastic difference. Life or death? Thing that's beneficial or the thing that's detrimental? The constructive or the destructive? The righteous or the sinful? The omnipotent or the impotent? Heaven or hell? God or money? Christianity or stuffitis, we might call it. You know, we've got a serious case in this country of stuffitis. And we've got to get over it. Because it's deadly. And it's not physically deadly, although some people do physically die from it, but it is spiritually deadly. We've got to make that choice. And we need to make the right choice. Choose God. Now Moses told the children of Israel on God's behalf, I set before you today life and death, good and evil, blessing and cursing. Be wise. Pick the good. Pick the good thing. You see, Jesus lays it out for us and He says, this is the two choices we have and this is the right choice. Aren't we glad He told us which one was the right choice? Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious. Or is it? Because an awful lot of people in this world make the wrong choice. But Jesus told us, this is the good choice. Pick this one. If you haven't been choosing God over the things in your life, and I know we've been using the term things, but you know, sometimes even people. I know they're not things, they're living beings, but even people can get in the way and be where God alone ought to be. We need to think about it. And we need to examine our motives, because again, it's not a certain dollar amount. One person might have $1 million and not be hoarding it. Other person may have $5 in their pocket and you couldn't get it away from them unless you shot them dead first. There'd be no way they'd part with it because they're so greedy holding on to it. They wouldn't spend it for anything. Well, it's not a money amount. It's a heart problem. And so it has to be addressed with a solution of the heart. Love God with your heart, soul, strength, and mind. That's the cure for materialism that ails so many. If you're suffering and you're struggling from that, and it will bring you misery, it will cause you to suffer. Maybe it's not yet. Maybe you want to stop before it starts. But if things are too important to you, and you have a need to respond to God's invitation tonight, please do so as we stand and as we sing.